Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen at izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Brian Mathis, who is former head bartender at the three-star Michelin restaurant Le Bernardin and brand ambassador for Great King Street and Compass Box Whiskies. And he also works at Coke Buzz Wine Studio and new American restaurant, The Gander, near Union Square. So hello and welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So we'll talk about a lot about shochu today, but first, how did you get into the world of cocktails?
Well, at the time, I was actually working in finance, and I sort of got into cocktails on my own, and it was something that became a little bit of a passion, and then I started bartending initially a few nights a week, and then made the switch full-time, and so then, yeah, kind of fell down the rabbit hole after that, first with cocktails and then many other things.
Oh, that's a lucky thing to happen. Right. And but, you know, you just knocked on the door of a bar and then let me work because you had, practice at home making cocktails. So.
Yeah, I mean, New York, you kind of have to hustle and try and get your way in, whether you start as a barback, which is sort of ideal because you can learn a lot of things that way, or you just sort of get lucky, which happened with me, and ended up initially at a Japanese restaurant where I was for a few years. Mm-hmm. So that's where my love for sake and shochu came in.
Right. That was the sake ten in?
Izakaya ten
in Chelsea.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So, okay. And then eventually you worked at the Le Bernardin.
Yeah, yeah. So I was another spot in between that, down in Tribeca, sort of more of a cocktail bar with a tasty menu. And then... Le Bernardin for 2.5 years.
Wow. Okay. So so how did you become interested in shochu?
So shochu, I mean, really, obviously had a little bit of experience with both sake and shochu before working at the Japanese restaurant. But that at Izakaya 10 was obviously being surrounded by it and serving it was something that I wanted to learn more about. And so largely, initially, it sort of started with sake and did a lot of stuff with that. And then shochu, it just sort of came about because there wasn't, at the time, much information about it.
Mm-hmm. So you got curious.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. But also, did you take courses to study shochu?
So not shochu. Shochu's, to my knowledge, there still really aren't courses available in English or in the U.S. There are a number in Japan.
Right.
For sake, however, there are some great opportunities, and I have taken a couple of courses with John Gontner, who I know you know
but
very well.
He's an American guy, but he spent years, and then he became an authority of sake, even among Japanese people.
Yeah, absolutely. Lived in Japan. I believe he's now back in Ohio for a little bit, but spends a tremendous amount of time still in Japan. He was in Japan for decades.
Mm-hmm. So you went to Japan to take his courses?
Yeah. So a couple times. Great opportunity. He also comes to the U.S. and teaches probably a few times a year in the States now. But at the time when he was still in Japan, he still does them in Japan as well. Mm-hmm. But great opportunity because you go and you basically do a classroom study for a few days, and then you go and travel and visit a few different breweries with him.
Right. And also you have a strong cultural influence. I use that to your wife, who is Japanese.
Yes, yes, right. Yes. So certainly a great opportunity for me to go to Japan, visit her family with her and her friends and, right. and all that.
Okay. So so what is special about shochu for you as a bartender?
I mean, so for me, one of the things is just the diversity. It's one of those, like many things, you sort of hear a little bit about it. Some of the myths are that it's like a Japanese vodka, which there are some that are vodka-like, but it really runs the gamut. Some are sort of like rums. Mm-hmm. You know, you have some that have whiskey-type aromas and flavors, and then there's just a whole lot of uniqueness and different types that really don't have any parallels. So okay. It's incredibly diverse. Also in strength. So, you know, it's great working with overproof spirits. Certain cocktails shine very well with a really strong whiskey, but sometimes you want a lower proof spirit. Mm. And shochu kind of runs the range from 20 to like 45% alcohol.
Wow.
So it really gives you a huge range, both flavors, strengths, aging. Some are oak aged, some are not. Most are not.
Okay. So I'll ask you more about the specifics of the shochu's basics, but I also heard you, in 2012, you earned a 5,000 scholarship from Tales of the Cocktail, which is a major organization of bartenders, and the theme of your project was called Shochu Beyond the Highball. Mm-hmm. So what was it?
So basically, Anne and Paul Tunerman, who are the founders and run Tales of the Cocktail, they've been very, very supportive. So there's a group of people every year called the Apprentices who basically go down there. It's the CAP program, and they run everything. So everything behind the scenes, all the cocktails, all the events, they're responsible for making sure that the cocktails are done correctly and the seminars run smoothly. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 2 years. And as a way to give back, Anne's created a scholarship fund. So you could propose whatever idea you want. They're completely open to it. Anything that you think can benefit the industry. So I presented shochu, something that, you know, like I said, there wasn't much information about. There's still not a lot, but there's a little bit more as a way to learn more about it and then come and educate more people about it.
Okay. So that was kind of a research project?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Right. So I twice specifically went just for shochu and visited a number of different producers and you know, traveled obviously to many different prefectures to do so and just saw a small bit of just how big the shochu world is.
Okay, so then that's the base, the knowledge of making shochu cocktails now, probably.
Yeah. I mean, I was doing a little bit of that at Izakaya 10 and you know, it's something that I try to do periodically, but it's for sure, it's something completely different. Mm-hmm. You can find, like I said, similarities in Western spirits, but it can also give you a flavor profile that you don't have anywhere else. So as a bartender, it's a great thing to have, quote-unquote, a new set of flavors to work with, even though it's been around, you know, like 500 years.
Yeah, so for listeners who don't know much about shochu, maybe you can explain what it is?
Yeah. So there's sort of two categories. There's otsurui and korui. And so one is a continuous distillation. That one would be sort of more, that's the korui. That would be more like your vodka. So that's sort of where people got that analogy. And, you know, it can be great for cocktails. Tends to be a little bit more, is more mass produced.
Right. And also because it's continuous, not much flavor is left.
It's going to be, a little more neutral, a little bit smoother. So if you want sort of more of a blank slate to work with in cocktails, it can be fantastic. Mm. So the price point on it, too, is obviously a bit lower.
Right. So the other one, otsu, is more traditional,
artisanal. Right. So honkaku, I mean, that's one thing that's amazing, too, is the sheer number of people making shochu in Japan. It's in the hundreds. So, you know, when you compare it to other major spirit categories, it's really amazing that there's all these different producers. many of them are family owned, many of them for multi-generations. So there's an incredibly rich history there. Largely a hands-on process.
Right.
When you're talking about sweet potato, they have to be processed very quickly and begin fermentation right away.
Yeah, I heard it originally came from Thailand via Okinawa Island, which is the southern island in Japan. And that's why it showed you now, they mostly are made in the southern island, especially at Kyushu.
Yeah, there's sort of two philosophies on that. One is that it was Thailand, Okinawa, and then reached Kyushu down in the south. And the other one is that it came from Korea, sort of down through like Iki Island and Nagasaki. Both probably have some truth. They probably sort of both came about similar times. And yeah, so certainly it's a very, very rich history.
Great. Yeah, I actually visited one of those, a few of those in Kyushu, Kumamoto. There's a region called Takuma. And they're really generations of producers, and they're so proud of what they make.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So what about the ingredients? Because, you know, Shochu is known for diversity of ingredients, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's sort of, I would say, three main ingredients. You have sweet potato, barley, and rice. Two others that are pretty prominent would be sugarcane and buckwheat.
Okay.
And then beyond that, almost anything you can think of. So, carrot, there's all kinds of crazy sesame. In the U.S., you'll see probably 20 different base ingredients. And sometimes it'll be, a combination. Even with, oftentimes with sweet potato, there'll be a bit of a rice component with the koji.
Right. Okay. So basically there is the very base, the mash is made with koji, which is aspergillus.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
right.
So
like
one thing that's, it's very unique to shochu, and something you see throughout Japanese, both beverages and cuisine, is koji. So you'll see it in miso. It's very prominent in sake as well. And one of the types, so there's three main types. You have a black, white, and yellow. Yellow is what they use for sake. And then with shochu, they have the other two. They have the white and black as well.
Right.
So it's basically, what it does is it helps in the saccharification process. So it helps convert the starch to sugar, which is obviously a key component because you need the sugar to then ferment into alcohol. And they also add flavors. So there's quite a bit of difference between the three.
So to create the base, the rice plus koji, and you add yeast and other, whatever the ingredients, as well as there's a starch that can convert it to sugar. You can do carrots or barley or anything.
Any of those. Water, of course.
Right. Yeah, the water is important.
Definitely.
Because it really indicates the terroir of the region.
Yeah, and definitely something that producers take a lot of pride in. Like you mentioned Kumamoto earlier, and they have this beautiful river. It's one of the most pure rivers in Japan. Many people draw from underground wells that are, located beneath beautiful mountain ranges.
Okay. So, all right. Now, when you make a, there are the two steps, right? And then you have to distill. So it's fermented and distilled. So the alcohol level, you said it can be very high, from 20 to 45.
Right, yeah.
So, the alcohol level is determined by the producer.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent. So if you're talking the continuous distillation, it's going to come off the still much higher, but it can only legally be bottled at the highest it can be is 35%. Whereas with Honkaku shochu, it's a single distillation. So it goes through a pot still one time. And it could come off the still probably anywhere from 36% to 45%. And then what, a lot of producers do is, like many other spirits, Western spirits, they do it all the time, where they'll add a bit of water to bring it down to a lower proof. One thing that's unique about shochu is it'll come down below what we're accustomed to seeing. So we generally see spirits in the 40, 45, sometimes 50 and higher percent ranges. With shochu, you can see it anywhere from 20 to 45%.
Right. Yeah, and I think shochu is becoming, especially that, otsu, the higher, the better quality shochu, is becoming more popular. And do you know why? What happened?
Well, I think, so one, in Japan, it's one thing that people have certainly latched onto. Same thing with sake. Premium sake is doing well in Japan. Sake overall is not doing super well. It's declining a little bit, but premium sake is doing well. And so, yeah, I think people have just they're discovering quality producers, and certainly in the U.S., it's growing. You know, it's still a very small category, but it's I think it comes down to the rich history and the flavors. When you taste them, when you taste really good shochu, it can shock a lot of people. I've done that with bartenders before that you know, sort of had the preconceived vision of it as vodka and not very interesting, and they walked away, you know, really, really blown away by just how diverse and the quality that they can represent.
And probably the demand for high quality shochu increased, so the producers started to be more aware, tried to make a better shochu, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm sure. There's certainly some modern techniques that people employ that they haven't always done, and some people are making it the way they've made it for hundreds of years. And
right.
Yeah, and you know, the simple, not simple, but the handmade process can really show through.
Right. Yeah, and there's one, I would say, incident, but in 2003, the Japanese media started to say shochu could prevent thrombosis. So just like, you know, 60 Minutes, the red wine became popular, you know, after 60 Minutes said it's good for your health in, I think, 1991. So it's the same thing happened in Japan, and the shochu became very popular.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the media helped.
There's also one of those beliefs that it's lower calorie, which it is, because it's lower proof. So that's another one that people said, oh, it's really healthy and good for you. You know, that's
right. Oh, and also the, you know, usually we'll talk about how to drink later, but it's usually diluted. So it ended up being cheaper than the other beverage too.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully people are still serving you the standard pour, whether they're adding water to it, whether it's in a cocktail or whatnot. It shouldn't hopefully be that they're giving you a smaller amount of shochu and more of a water or whatever.
Right, so that they can taste shochu.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And also, I found a crazy story. So there's a popular brand called the Morizo, and it really indicates how the premium brands are really becoming popular. So this Morizo, it retails at $30 at the website, but if you want to get it, you have to sign up for an auction. And if you get lucky, you can buy it. But otherwise, you have to get on Japan Airlines first or business class and buy it from Sky Mall. And there is a black market or, you know, open market. And I checked the price. It could be up to $300.
So. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it's like a lot of things like Pappy Van Winkle here in America. Jiondai, as far as sake is concerned in Japan, there's certain cult producers that, you know, no question make absolutely great products, but people sort of latch onto them, and then the market will take it where it will take it.
So. Like the wine spring, Screaming Eagle. So there's a reason, I'm sure. Good wine, good spirits.
Yeah, no question. You know, it's like certain Burgundy producers, obviously there's very small production, and if more people want those wines or shochu or whatever it is, the price is going to rise.
Right, so shochu joined the group.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And what's the aging process? Like, you know, you ferment... not aging, but the fermentation, you know, you have to ferment the mash, right? And I heard usually they use a small ceramic pot instead of bigger, you know, big tanks.
Yeah, oftentimes. I mean, some people do use stainless as well. You'll certainly see ceramic. It's sometimes, relatively small compared to really, really big tanks. Sometimes they'll be glass-lined ceramic. But one thing that's interesting, too, is that it's generally a multiple-stage fermentation. So you generally have two steps, and then also, similar to sake, it undergoes multiple parallel fermentation. So while the starches are being converted to sugar, the sugar is being converted to alcohol at the same time. So that's another sort of very unique process.
So it provides more complexity of the flavors because there's so many things going on. There's more byproducts.
Yeah, more complexity. It can also help it reach a little bit higher alcohol content way through the fermentation process before they distill it.
Right. And also that, you know, ceramic pots, when you ferment shochu, I heard the taste makes taste becomes milder.
Yeah, certainly. You have, you know, you have interaction with any sort of non-inert container, whether it's ceramic or wood or whatnot, where you'll have both oxygen interaction,
right,
and then from the material itself that it sort of gives and takes away from it. So,
oh, right. Like, I wouldn't say as much as a sherry, but some sort of...
Yeah. Certainly, oxygen. Yeah, softer, like you said, it'll sort of round it out more.
Interesting. Right. And do they eat shochu in barrels, like whiskey? Or?
There is a little bit of that, yeah. So that's one of those that I think can be very interesting, you know, to sort of be an intro, for one thing, to people, to say, hey, here's something that has some similarities to what you've tasted, whether it's Scotch whiskey or other products. But, yeah, so you're starting to see some more of that, and there's some that are really, really interesting.
Mm, okay. Yeah, I asked because I went to one of the distillers, and there is a secret barrel-aged 30-year-old shochu, and I tasted it. It exactly tastes like single malt Scotch. But they couldn't release it because Japanese whiskey companies made a regulation. If it's colored, shochu cannot be sold to the market because they're a strong competitor. So that means the shochu can be very high-quality beverage.
Yeah, it's that's sort of one of those funny rules and regulations. Now the Japanese whiskey certainly needs no help. It's extremely popular. But yeah, at one time, that became the rule, and it's still in place today, that shochu cannot get beyond a certain darkness, which the great thing about that is that you know that there's nothing added to it. It's completely natural, but yeah, it's unfortunate. It'd be pretty fun to try that 30-year-old shochu.
Right. So, all right. So now let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about shochu, how to taste shochu and shochu cocktails.
Excellent.
So please stay with us.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Brian Mathis, who is a former head bartender at Lou Bernardin, brand ambassador for Great King Street and Compass Box Whiskies, and he also serves creative cocktails at Coke Buzz Wine Studio and the Gander near Union Square. We talked about what shochu is, so let's talk about its taste. Actually, Brian brought a couple bottles of shochu to the studio, so we can just go through what they are and then can describe the flavors.
Yeah, I thought it'd be fun for us to taste it since we're actually talking about it. So I brought a few different ones. Like I said, there's a huge variety. We could easily taste 20 different shochu and not really repeat stuff. So like we said, the base material obviously can come into play, the type of koji. We actually didn't talk about, there's two different types of distillation. There's regular atmospheric distillation, and then there's a reduced pressure distillation.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're trying to do there, they'll actually get the alcohol to boil at a lower temperature through a vacuum, and it will sort of preserve more delicate aromas. So if it's reduced pressure, it's generally going to be a little bit lighter, a little more delicate. And if it's normal pressure,
you know, can run the gamut from kind of normal to kind of pretty earthy and funky.
Right. So the higher pressure one is more rustic and original, and then lower pressure is more modern style.
Yeah, but rustic in a good way, because some of your really prized shochu out there are atmospheric pressure distillation. So by no means is it they're both great techniques. It doesn't mean that the vacuum is better.
Okay. Right.
So so the first one is from Takahashi Shuzo. So you mentioned earlier Kumamoto. Mm-hmm. So this is in the Kuma Valley, and this is going to be a rice shochu. So one thing that's really cool about this is that it sort of, they use a Ginjo sake yeast. Mm-hmm. So for somebody that's familiar with sake, when he knows this and tastes it, it has that similarity to it. Mm-hmm. So you kind of know right away a familiarity. So you'll have certain fruit aromas, floral aromas. Mm-hmm. It is higher in alcohol, so 25%. You know, most sake are going to be 15-16%. Some can get as high as 19-20-21. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this distilled, obviously. Mm. And if you want to nose it, taste a little bit.
Sure, I can smell that. So the name of the shochu is Shiro. That means
Shiro.
White.
Yeah. Right. So it's white koji in this case. Mm-hmm. And we're going to taste all three different types of koji.
Sure.
But so you can really sort of tell that it's, you know, it has a fruitiness and a lightness, both on the aroma and the palate.
Mm-hmm. So the label is in Japanese, actually all in Japanese, and this is a modern silver label, and yeah, it's beautiful. You can just put it in your shelf.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that the Japanese do packaging extremely, extremely well. And some of the labels go back hundreds of years, and some are more modern, but they're all beautiful.
Okay, so the next one.
So the next one, we're going to do a lighter style of emo or sweet potato. So this one is Tomino Hozon. Mm-hmm. And so this one's a yellow koji. Mm-hmm. And it does both atmospheric and regular pressure distillation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this one's really interesting because it's sweet potato, which tend to be a little bit earthier. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get a ton of different flavors and aromas.
Right. And this is just the, you know, in Japan, I think emo is potato, sweet potato shochu is very popular.
Extremely,
and,
yeah.
I mean, I think for beginners, people say it's very strong, but once you get it, it gets addictive.
Yeah, for sure. So if it was your first shochu experience, the previous one would be a great one to start with.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. Depends on who it is. So when we're talking bartenders or whatnot, a lot of them really love emo. They love sweet potato because it's, you know, it's complex and earthy and really interesting.
Right.
And this one, you know, you can, I think it's not super pungent. So I think it is approachable.
Right. Sweeter.
Yes.
Flavor.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. So the name of the shochu is Takarayama. That means treasure mountain.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, my Japanese is still not good.
Well, but you know, it's everything's in Japanese and Japanese style label. So does that attract American consumers? Maybe.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's one of those. Some people are doing a better job with the back label, which is always important. Like, I don't think you should change the front label. Mm-hmm. For, you know, sometimes there'll be Roman lettering, so English at the bottom, but then you'll still have the kanji up top, which I think is important. That's you know, how it is in
kanji
Japan.
Kanji, Japanese character. Right. Yeah. So is there any back label, some ideas that...
So some of them, yeah. Some give more information than others, certainly, but you'll always have the name. It's similar sort of with Nihonshu or with sake.
Right. It's so you can just guess what the ingredients are. That's like for sweet potato and this one.
Yeah. I mean, this one... You know, if you go to the right stores, they should certainly be able to tell you what's in it. But looking at it, it says emo on the back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. All right.
So next we're going to do a mugi or barley shochu. This one is a little more fully flavored. That's why I decided to do it after the Tomino Hozon.
Okay.
So this one is also unfiltered. This one's called Arc Jakunbaku, and it's from Nishi Yoshida in Fukuoka. So I don't know if I talked, the last one was from Kagoshima.
Mm-hmm.
This one's from Fukuoka Prefecture, so a little bit north on the island of Kyushu.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, so unfiltered. So you'll really get sort of a richness here.
Right. Yeah, you can definitely smell the grain, you know, the barley.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
Wow. So that's the yellow koji? No, the black koji?
So this one is black.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now that's why it's more robust.
Yeah, you get sort of a richer, darker flavor, if you will, from black koji.
Mm. There's like a chocolate nose.
Yeah,
that stays
for sure.
Come to my nose.
I think it might even say that. If not on the back label, it definitely says that somewhere in the tasting notes. Mm. But yeah, for sure, you get sort of a chocolate toffee
amazing
flavor. Yeah.
It's like a whiskey almost.
Yeah, for sure. Right. So in this case, unaged, I didn't actually bring one that is oak aged. We can certainly do that in the future.
Right.
Because that can be a really interesting addition to the flavor profile.
Okay. And the last one.
The last one. So this one is also from Fukuoka. Mm-hmm. This one is a sweet potato called Jinpu from Kitaya.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular one that I brought is a Genshu. So
the undiluted.
Undiluted. So the one they sell here is a little bit lower in alcohol. This one's a little bit higher. So I brought this one back.
What's the alcohol level of the last one?
This one is 40.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 40%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a little bit more in line with what we see in the U.S. But like I said, that shouldn't be a concern for people, the alcohol percentage. Because in Japan, most of them are 25%.
Mm.
You know, that's one misperception that some people have had is that, oh, they're sending us a lower proof spirit of what they have at home. But that's definitely not the case.
Hmm. Okay. So usually, how do you drink shochu? Say you go to a store and get a nice bottle of shochu. What's your recommendation?
So, I mean, it really depends on how you like to drink spirits in general. I mean, we've been sipping these neat and... I think you'd agree. At room temperature, they're delicious at room temperature. Mm. There's a few different ways they do it in Japan. One is mizuwari, so with water.
Mm.
And, you know, another one, so you sort of mentioned earlier, shochu beyond the highball. You'll see highballs or chuhai.
Mm-hmm.
Chuhai is even sold in cans in Japan.
Mm. So chuhai, by the way, the whiskey and soda is a highball here in America, but chuhai is the... shochu plus other beverage, right? So I think the Suntory, you know, the company that was featured in the Losing Translation in the movie, that created the boom of chuhai.
Yeah, for so, sure. For
yeah,
sure.
Several that, years ago.
Yeah. So yeah, you get them with soda and then different flavorings. But yeah, so that's one way. Ouyuwari with hot water is another way. You mix it with hot water. Another traditional way is called maiwari, where they mix it with water previously, so maybe a few days ahead of time, generally in an earthenware pot, and it'll sit for a few days. The idea being that it will sort of marry with the water and create a more integrated flavor profile.
Right. And with some milk oxygen.
Yeah, of course, and then, I mean, cocktails are like I said, a huge category to play with. Just all these different flavor profiles from the base materials, the different koji, the different types of yeast, different aging techniques.
Right. So, you know, that characteristics, you know, compared to other spirits, how do you use shochu? You know, you have like a lot of choices in front of you, I'm sure, always. But do you pick shochu for certain reasons?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's whatever spirit you're using, you want to make sure, or really whatever ingredient goes into a cocktail, you want to make sure that it shows in that cocktail. So, you know, if you're doing something with say the first one, which is a little bit lighter style, you could certainly do a lighter style aperitif cocktail with that. That would be delicious. There's a lot of classic sort of interpretations. Take a classic cocktail and just swap shochu for whether it's whiskey, whether it's tequila, whether it's gin, rum. You could plug it in, and then all kinds of other unique ingredients. There's a tremendous number of Japanese ingredients that I've used both with Western spirits and Japanese ingredients as well.
It must be interesting because, you know, compared to vodka, for instance, you have a lot of flavors in potatoes, barley, like we just even by smelling, you can tell the diversity.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
It may be challenging, but fun for bartenders.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for bartenders, it's great because it's a whole, like I said, quote unquote, new set of flavors to work with and play around with. And,
right.
You know.
Yeah. And how, like, can you just give me some examples of cocktails that you made with shochu?
Yeah, so one that I've done actually with Tomino Hozon, I did one with dashi, which was pretty unique. So it was originally something that I did to go alongside tequila called a sangrita, and I sort of adapted that to go with the Imo shochu. So I did yuzu. So yuzu is a great citrus from Japan. It's really unique flavors. A little togarashi, which provides spice.
Yeah, just a little chili pepper.
Yeah, a little heat, and there's some sesame and stuff in it. So yeah, and then dashi, which it's very interesting. We left one shochu producer in Kagoshima, and I walked outside and I said, "Wow, it smells like dashi or katsuobushi."
Mm, so dashi basically usually it's a combination of flavor, like umami elements. That's the fifth savory taste, the bonito flake and the kombu cooked together.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, so in this place there was a bonito factory right next door. And, you know, so that sort of gave me the idea of pairing those together. So dashi is one of those, you know, it's that the great stock of Japan. And, you know, I wasn't trying to be weird or kitschy or anything with it, but when you get a really great dashi, you can drink it by itself, and it's this amazing flavor. So in the case of that cocktail, I paired it with, you know, a little bit of acidity from the yuzu and some grenadine and the spice, and it worked out.
Because, like, really, you know, well, there's a bacon boom in cocktails. You can find bacon in even ice cream. There's a bacon ice cream a couple of years ago here in New York. So it's the same idea. Savory thing works in cocktails.
Yeah, I think it's, in that case, doing something savory. You know, I've done it with coconut and like a brown butter syrup for something a little bit richer, a little bit sweeter. All kinds of other stuff, different sodas, umeshu. I've done umeshu in cocktails, which works out great.
Right. Wow. So sounds like you can just do whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, many, many choices and options. Mm-hmm. No question.
Right. Okay. So I also understand you had a organized shochu tasting events in the past. So is that for the trade or consumers or both?
Generally trade focused so far. I've done a couple. I did one in the fall and one early winter, which was great. So those were all focused at trade, whether it's, you know, bartenders, sommeliers, other buyers, or media, which was great to sort of, again, I think it's new to a lot of people. So if we can get those people educated about it first, it will help ultimately trickle down to consumers. And but yeah, I'd certainly love to do more with consumers as well, because I think it's one of those categories. Once people taste it, they really, really see that the diversity and everything is something that they can fall in love with.
Right. So how did they react, the guests of the events?
Yeah, no, people I think are always a little bit surprised about the variety, for one thing. Because, you know, when you don't have a ton of information about it, and maybe you hear the vodka rumor, you think it's going to be a little bit more neutral and more simple. But then when you taste, you know, 10 or 15 different shochu, and, you know, we saw here tasting four different ones, that it's just a huge variety. So people were really positive about it. And in both cases, we also did some cocktails as well. So that's, I think, also a great way to show people that, you know, not everybody likes to drink spirits by themselves. They want, you know, cocktails are obviously hugely popular, so it's a great way for people to experience shochu. And
right, yeah, and it sounds like because you visited distillers, you are more, even more impressed. So, do you think some distilleries are open to the public? Like, you know, say, if I was listening to this program, and then let's go to Japan, and then let's visit the distillery. Is it possible?
Yeah, there's no question. Some of them, you know, have regularly organized tours that they'll give. I think it's maybe a little bit more established in the sake and nihonshu world at the moment than it is in shochu. But, you know, sometimes language can be a barrier. But I think if you reach out to people, there's a number of distilleries that would be more than happy to have people visit.
Okay. That's great. And by the way, what's the recommendation for liquor stores or bars for shochu here in New York?
Oh, so yeah. So Sakaya, which is a great sake store, they have it as well.
In East Village.
Yeah. Astor Wine and Spirits, which is, you know, on Lafayette. Landmark is also another very good one.
Right.
And then bars, I mean, most sake bars also have some shochu as well. So if you go to sake specific bars, there's one particular shochu bar that I know of called Ume no I in the East Village.
Okay.
There's most Japanese restaurants are going to have a few, and there's even some non-Japanese restaurants are starting to branch out. So
that's interesting.
Hopefully we'll see more of that.
Right. Yeah, and also like the Ambassador Wines in Midtown sells like 30 shochu.
Yeah.
And they have like 200 sakes, something like that.
Yeah, right. great spot.
Right, yeah. Well, by the way, have you been to cocktail bars in Japan? Because you're a bartender, you know, I heard the cultural difference is quite huge between American bars and Japanese cocktail bars.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly it's changing a little bit as there's more and more interaction between bartenders from all over the world, which is fantastic. Traditionally, I would say that they were more sort of elegant. They're very, very focused on presentation. So watching a Japanese bartender work was absolutely beautiful. Just their movements and very clean, very precise, very focused on classics. They did classics extremely, extremely well. But you know, some of the younger guard Japanese bartenders are super, super creative as well, and doing some really, really cool, interesting stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I think in Japan, if you go to a restaurant, usually there's no waiting bar, so people go to a cocktail bar before or after dinner, and then, you know, you open the door, there's like dark, really classic ambience, and the people quiet, and it's really fun, you know, it's a totally different experience.
Yeah, oftentimes a little bit smaller. You know, we certainly have some bars in New York that are pretty small, but some of the ones in Japan can be really, really small, maybe like 8-10 seats, and which is great because you get, you know, a one-on-one experience almost with the bartender. So it can be very personalized.
Right. And they carve ice for you by hand.
Yes. So that's, we're starting to see more of that in the States, but certainly the clear ice, Japanese have been doing it for years and years.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And also sometimes they wear tuxedos. You know,
yes. Again, the elegance is fantastic.
Right. Okay. So anyways, thank you so much for joining us today, Brian. And thank you for tasting Tasty Chochu.
My pleasure.
Right. So listeners, if you'd like to know more about Brian, Brian's cocktails or any advice about cocktails, please visit his Facebook page, Brian Mathis. That's Brian, MATTHYS. And if you have any questions or comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can also reach me at akikokatayama.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. I'll see you next week.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.